New York Real Talk with Pamela Sue Mann, Alex Lefchuk, and some incredibly inspiring guest co-presenters from the city that never sleeps via Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting.
Well, when you actually got the list of Wolverhampton, Walsall, Liverpool, Birmingham, London, and Middlesbrough in there, clearly you're on a winner as far as I'm concerned. As I'm actually currently in Middlesbrough, why not indeed? But if you also add to that Nantes, France, clearly you've got a special kind of multimedia exhibition and coordinator to hand. And that indeed is just part of the backstory of the person we're delighted to welcome to New York Real Talk today. Of course, it's the wonderful Adrian Clamp. How are you, Adrian?
I'm fine, Alex. How are you?
Excellent. Now, I've got to tell you, I've got to ask you, whereabouts in Middlesbrough did you exhibit?
It was actually at an arts centre in the centre of Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And it was the International Drawing Biennale exhibition that held
twice
a year.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's great
stuff.
To be part of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the key thing is, it is, of course, a joint show. Pamela Sue Mann, New York Real Talk. Pamela, how did you actually encounter Adrian then? I mean, there's another link, obviously, with your good self and the northeast of England from, of course, the joys of New York.
You know, there's an interesting sort of cyber reality of people that we know in terms of somewhere in the Bowie world and somewhere in the music world and somewhere in the music and art crossover world, that one really has a hard time pinpointing just where and when a connection was made. Is that a good answer? I don't know. How did we, it was basically, how did we come across one another?
Hi, Pamela. Yeah, I think it was through Facebook. I think we'd had sort of mutual friends on Facebook. And I think our crossover was there. And I may have commented on a few things that you'd posted on Facebook. And I think it came about from that, really.
You know, it's all roads back lead back to David Bowie, Alex.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I could actually cite the connection with the wonders of Clapham and the area of Clapham that David was actually born in, because I used to pass that by regularly on my first sort of radio sojourn back in the 1980s. So it all interconnects together, really.
It does. It does. Well, I first met Bowie in 1973. On the 28th of May, so it goes back quite a long way. I was a huge fan in my teens, so you know, it sort of led me to first come to New York, because as a child I'd seen images of New York on TV and it just looked fascinating to me, and I'd had a desire to go for some time. So the first time was in 2007, got the opportunity. So
well, there we are. So, and that obviously qualifies you for New York Real Talk. Favorite David Bowie tune or melody or song?
I've got quite a few.
The
first track I really heard was obviously Starman. The first track I bought was John I'm Only Dancing. But a real important one for me, I think, in terms of like New York City, was Queen Bitch.
Sweet-talking night-walking games. Oh, and she's known in the darkest clubs for pushing ahead of the dames. She says she can't do it, then she can't do it. She don't make false claims. But she's a queen, and such a queen, such a laughter is sucked in the brain. Now she's leading them on, and she'll lay them right down.
Kathy Mansour has joined us as well, based in Lincoln, England currently, but from Miami, and of course with lots of New York credentials as well. Pamela, do you want to open up the questioning with respect to the multimedia talented soul that is Adrian Clamp, who I suspect is from Birmingham or the Birmingham region, Adrian?
I'm near to Birmingham. I'm a little bit further north. I'm actually in Wolverhampton for the Sims.
And of course, great celebrations in Wolverhampton today because they've just thrashed Liverpool 3-0. So
yeah,
there you are.
Absolutely. That was unforeseen. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. It had to happen. Anyway, enough of such sporting stuff. Pamela, yeah. Back to you.
Yes, yes. If it includes sporting, I I know nothing. I am like it'll just bounce off me if there's some sort of sporting news that comes my way and from anywhere in the world. It will just I deflect it. It doesn't exist in my reality. You know, I've come to realize that the something that is also interesting, always interesting to me, is the genesis of things. And I'm so curious as to what your first moment was when you knew that you were definitely an artist, you were definitely a creative, you were definitely someone who saw the world through your unique visual lens and sort of had to express yourself in that way for your life.
I think if I go right back to maybe I was about 7 or 8, and I think I had some kind of feel for everything visual, and I enjoyed music as well, and I was less academic. So I think that sort of really focused my attention on things that I really enjoyed. And I thought that I could do well. I was sort of complimented as well by teachers at school and supported by teachers at school. And I remember one teacher asking me to help him out. I was 9 years of age at the time. Help him out to paint a backdrop for a school play. And we had to do all these big screens and figures painted. And he says, can you help me out with this? And I thought, well, I must be pretty good, as he sort of asked me. So I think the early sort of growth of my artistic background went back to, I was about sort of 7, 8, 9 years of age. And it's something that I could really relate to and I enjoyed doing. I was encouraged to do as well.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to see from that first spark, where it goes, where it takes you, what comes in, and what's the first thing you follow with all your passion? You know, what takes you in a certain direction? What do you think brought you into the world of reimagining Bowie through you being affected by him. Like what I don't know if my questioning is clear, but I don't know if you understand what I'm asking.
I think I understand that question, Pamela, because I think myself, I saw myself as a bit of an outsider. I know a lot of people that got into Bowie quite early on felt that they could relate to him, and he was sort of inviting them to be themselves and saying, look, it's okay to be different, and it's okay to be creative. You don't have to follow the family tradition or values of employment. You can do your thing. And coming from a single parent background as well, it was quite difficult living with my mother, my two brothers, to sort of take the plunge into art college, because it was quite expensive, and my mother struggled a little bit at the time. But that's when I started to seriously play in a band. So I started to play in clubs and pubs to support my college income. I think I was earning about £10 a week in the band, and that used to supplement my grant, you know. So, you know, that's where the music and art crossover came, I think, being into Bowie and then realising my potential maybe as an artist, taking that up as a profession, and seeing how music could actually help me to fund my career as an artist and enjoy performing as a sort of musician, I'll say.
The art college phenomenon, of course, responsible for so many entrants into the rock world. Of course, back in the 1950s, we have John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Brian Ferry, Bowie himself, of course, David Jones. Clearly, it was a very productive line, and probably actually gave birth to what Tony Blair said in the 90s was Cool Britannia, after a fashion. Interesting why, with this obsession with the STEM and science, technology, education and maths, that's being manifested through the educational system, whether we'll actually get that renewal of the creative, because I do feel we need both. I mean, that's a potentially a heavy political point, Adrian, but again, any thoughts on that?
Well, the one section of I think the curriculum to suffer is usually the art, isn't it? That people say you've got to do the sciences, you've got to do the maths, and the academic side. And when you think of our tourist industry, it's not really, really based on that sort of thing. Okay, there's the economic value of that. But what do people usually come or, you know, travel overseas to see? They go to museums, they go to galleries. I want to see these huge murals like in New York City or in Bristol. And I think really we need to think of it, you know, in the long term, you know, as well as the short term, that artists, current artists now, are providing some kind of support system for artists in the future. You know, we're getting all these people traveling to Britain or in America or wherever, Central Europe, wherever it might be. And I think the arts encourage people to travel and, you know, add to the economy. I think it's an important thing that's overlooked.
And of course, there are lots of balances with commodification of the culture that also need to be developed. But I have to congratulate you, Adrian, because I never thought I'd ever hear a guest actually utter the words Bristol and New York in the same sentence. And you just did. It's phenomenal. It's great. I'm always going to say, get off my land. But anyway, over to Kathy Manso. Kathy, go.
Hello. Hi. So hi. I was looking into your website, and there's a lot of beautiful pieces that you have, but I think what really shocked me the most, because I just couldn't imagine myself doing this, was your self-portrait from 2010. And I find that such a, I guess the best word to say is, like, you're really exposing yourself, you know, and that's something that I think any person would find difficult to do. So the question I wanted to ask is, how did you feel creating that, and what encouraged you to do so?
Was this the one with the hand up on the face?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. At the time, I was really interested in some images that I'd seen that were from the First World War. And there were images by an artist named Henry Tonks. And Henry Tonks, I believe, started as his profession as a surgeon. And then he changed profession to become an artist. and he recorded some of the victims of atrocities in the First World War. And there was a surgeon who worked in Sidcup in London, who was trying to assist with very early forms of plastic surgery. And that sort of promoted me to do a whole series of paintings based on, I call it my blue series, because it's based on blue benches and blue suits, where a number of these victims, when they were in public spaces, they had to wear a blue suit or they sat on blue benches to warn the public that they were around, because the facial features were so shocking. And it was really a bit of a homage to that. And I really felt for these people, you know, and that was really what led to that portrait. It was a sort of homage to these people who'd served their country. And it was also a new way of exploring portraiture. I thought it was a good choice, good direction for me as well.
And I also saw that you are a teacher, a lecturer, a tutor, and
I am, yes.
Depending which word you want to choose for yourself.
Yeah.
And I was kind of curious, what's your process? How do you teach a class? If I were to come in, what would happen?
I normally start with drawing, and I use it, ask students to bring work along as well, so I can actually see what their sort of focus has been in the past, if they've done any artwork. And then I sort of try and encourage different kind of drawing practices, using different materials, different subject matters, different time spans on the work. So I might do sort of short drawing exercises or much longer week by week drawing exercises. And then I'll lead them into colour. We might do some colour work in dry pastels, things like that. And then I'll look at sort of colour and science and a little bit of theory, which is pretty easy to grasp the way in which I introduce that into the programme. We look at a group of French artists called the Pointillists. I don't know if you're familiar with their work. Georges Seurat was the leading artist of that movement, really. So it's sort of an introduction into fine-tuning the eye, like a musician would fine-tune his ear for sound. It's to get people to look at some of those intricacies and subtleties of colours. And then we'll sort of branch out into sort of much broader media, acrylic, maybe some oil painting, and then look at sort of landscape work or portraiture. And I always try and sort of teach a little bit of myself, but I don't encourage people to work like me. You know, it's really to do with my passion. You know, as an artist, I'm very passionate as a tutor as well. So I try and encourage people in the way in which I was encouraged as a pupil, if you like.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing to see, because how you were explaining earlier how academically it wasn't something you were really into until, because you were so creative and you wanted to go more into a creative aspect, but you kind of found yourself back into this role of teacher. So it's interesting that you found a place to not only just help others, but use that passion in an academic setting.
Absolutely. I mean, it's strange how it's all panned out, really, because I'm self-employed. I worked in mainstream education in FE for about 22 years, and then I decided to focus on my work and exhibiting. But now, because I'm self-employed, I have to do my own books. I have to count up all my receipts and present.
I think it's fair to say, Adrian, that even in New York, they're not familiar with the terror that the words Schedule D can actually provide for you. I mean, I know they have their own Inland Revenue Service, but Schedule D is something which I've had lots of people sort of get very frustrated about in terms of the returns of tax and so on. But there we are.
You know, it's interesting. They're actually teaching now in some schools, because actually my daughter and I have been starting to tour universities and colleges for the arts. And it is interesting because some programs actually do teach, and I think that this needs to happen across the board globally everywhere, artists how to sort of manage their budget, manage themselves, or try and find funding for their projects and things like that. And there was none of that when I was in music school.
Yeah.
And I just think it's important. It's the financial aspect can determine whether your work sees the light of day. You know, there was something really interesting you said, just really clicked. It also has to do with my daughter and I went to see the there's an immersive sort of a Monet exhibit, which is not, it travels around, and we just saw it the other day. Actually, sorry, I was with my sister, not my daughter, but that's not important. And it was really interesting how they would have been great for schools, because they were just immersing everyone in a very basic way in the world of Monet. And something you were saying, I wrote down eyes and ears of a generation, because the artists, be they your writers, painters, dancers, the creative artists, music makers, painters, all forms of art, they're the eyes and the ears of a generation. They have eyes and ears of a time. You know, now we look back and we listen to someone like Chopin and we go, oh, isn't that lovely? It's lovely. You know, or we, you know, we look at Monet's work. But in their time, they were really, really pushing boundaries, which is almost hard to imagine. But looking at things that are now, looking at what's going on in the world, and then painting it, in your case, literally, through your eyes, through your lens, the way you're seeing what is right now, it's your snapshot of the world right now. So I do believe that artists are the eyes and the ears of a particular time in the world, and they're so very important. And yet, the irony is that it's so very difficult to live your life as an artist, because you do have to balance your checkbook, providing there's something coming in. You have to figure out what to do with it and how to make it into art and how to feed yourself. And yeah, it's so interesting, so important what you do.
Well, it's such a solitary industry, I feel. And, you know, I think all artists, certainly for me, are sensitive. I'm quite sensitive. I think Bowie was sensitive as well. But also having that curiosity about the world. You know, you're talking about being the ears and the eyes of the world. You're constantly looking for things that could inspire you, or you're trying to make a social commentary about something. So you do have to be alert and be conscious of your surroundings. And I think a lot of great art is a reflection of the artist's own environment, you know, as a personal thing. You know, I think that's really important. So I think your point is valid, very valid indeed. Yeah,
I'm just intrigued and quite frankly shocked that Pamela actually still uses checkbooks. I thought I was the only person who actually still wrote the occasional check on a monthly basis, but still, never mind. That's digital technology and digital transactions working through us. Adrian, do you have a favorite Pamela Sue Mann piece of music that maybe inspires you to create material?
Well, that's something I'm really going to focus in on. I'm going to look at this, because it's great having this connection. So, yeah, I'm going to really look at Pamela's work and really check it out and, yeah, just see if something comes for me, you know.
Okay, well, I'll reverse it slightly and say, Pamela, what would you like us to play now to effectively sort of provide Adrian with a little insight into the interesting world of Pamela Sue Mann, musical creator?
You know, Alex, you are, you know, God love you.
Well, I hope she does.
Yeah, I hope she does as well. Yeah, sure.
There you go.
Yeah. We could work on a joint project, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, don't evade the question, Pamela. Which one do you want us to play for you?
I'm going to bat the question over to Kathy, because I can't possibly say that. It's so self-involved for me to be like, well, enough about me. What do you think about me?
Fair point. Kathy Manso, can you solve the conundrum?
If we're going to pick a song. We're going to pick the song that's always stuck in my head, and it's Pink Flamingo.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you.
Supermarket with you. Wanna dance in the supermarket with you. Wanna dance in the Let's dance like pink flamingos do. And I will dance like me. And you will dance like you.
There we are, Pink Flamingos, which of course featured another multimedia artist who we featured, Diane Boivin, who was also featured within that. So, Adrian, who knows? You may soon get a request to actually appear in one of Pamela's music videos. So, who knows what could happen on that sort of basis?
Who knows? That'd be nice.
But it has brought us neatly round to Pamela, your wacky New York moment question.
Okay, and I definitely did not give him the heads up on this one. But I think it's better not to tell people beforehand. Because
I agree.
Like in true Alex fashion, you're just catching people off guard. So Adrian, in all your times in New York, did you have something that stood out as a memory as particularly bizarre? We know that New York City is a place where bizarre things happen to happen. You know, they happen to people. Some kind of energy vortex. You know, something's going on. But is there something that sticks in your mind as something really strange, really bizarre that you noticed or you experienced or happened to you that you survived in New York City?
Yeah. There's a couple of things, actually, Pamela. The first time we visited New York for about 9 days, and on the seventh day, we'd gone to the Museum of Modern Art, and I'd purchased an exhibition catalogue by Chuck Close, the artist. And the next day, which was the last but one day before our holiday ended, we were walking along the street, and I think it was on Lafayette, and I was looking at a map, and this fella came up to me, and he said, what are you looking for? And I said, I'm looking for places of cultural interest. And he said, oh, I'm an artist. And I said, oh, are you really? He says, yeah. He says, my studio's around the corner. And I said, where's that then? And he said, well, do you want to come? And I said, yeah, sure. My wife looked at me as if I was absolutely crazy. You know, we just met this guy in the street and we're going to go around his house. So off we walk, myself, my wife, and this guy. He gets to his apartment. He shows me his work, which was fantastic, his gallery, his living space. And he was a lecturer at Columbia University, and his name was Charles Myers, really lovely fellow. And we were having a chat, and he said, well, your work's figurative. He says, across the street, he says, is Chuck Close's studio. He says, I know he's at home because his car's outside. And he says, just go across and just knock the door. And who knows, you know, you might get to meet Chuck Close. So I said goodbye to Charles, made my way out of his apartment, walked across the road. And I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this guy must be having me on, you know. The day before, I bought this exhibition catalog for Chuck Close. I meet this guy, and he said, just go across the road and you might meet this Chuck Close. So went across the road, and there was a little bell on the door. They got C Close. So I pressed the doorbell. The door opened. A young chap came out, and he said, what do you want? And I said, well, can I meet Chuck Close? Is he around? And he said, he's just started working. He doesn't meet anyone when he started to work. And I said, oh, that's okay. It's fine. He said, where are you from? I said, we're from England. He said, well, hang on. So he goes inside, comes back out a bit, 15 seconds later, and she's coming in. So we go through the front door, and I'm looking at the ground thinking, oh, what have I done, you know? And I look up, and there's Chuck. And as you probably know, he had an aneurysm quite early on in his life, and he's in his wheelchair. And he was looking at me, smiling, and I thought, well, that's a good sign. So I went up to Chuck Close, shook his hand and said, I'm so pleased to meet you. Thank you for allowing me into your studio. And that was just a bizarre encounter for me. And he, you know, it was something that I really appreciated Charles, you know, offering to me as a visitor to New York. And he was fantastic, you know.
Amazing. I mean, it is magical like that. Wouldn't you say, Kathy? There's a magic beauty in it.
Well, yeah. And just the magic of like, I'm going to ask and see what happens. And it's like, oh my God, it's happening.
Yeah. I always work on this assumption or theory that they can only say no, but they can also say yes. So, you know.
Yeah, no, that's so courageous. I'm so afraid of the no.
I couldn't let that opportunity go.
No, that's so fantastic. That's a that's actually an uplifting, incredible story. Because I don't know how many years ago this was. Would this have been quite a long time ago, or
2007? Presumably
2007. That's the first time we went to New York. Yeah.
Goodness sake, yeah. Pamela, pay attention. Adrian said that about 10 minutes ago. Goodness me. Sometimes she phases out, Adrian. I don't know.
Pamela, are you as nervous as me during this chat?
Always. I'm always.
I am.
Yeah, I live in a state of nervousness and forgetfulness. So.
I know that well. I know that very well.
No, I was thinking, well, 2007 now is a bit of time ago. I'm thinking in New York time. It's like dog years. It's very different. Right? So
what month in 2007?
No, it's true. I was thinking, what were rents back then? Because it all ties in with artists. Patti Smith had said, I don't know if she said it to someone or she said it in a book or an interview, but basically saying, you know, musicians don't live here now because you can't afford it. You can't make your art. You won't have time for your art because you, unless you have some kind of hack into being in the city and being able to afford to be in the city, it is prohibitively expensive. And so you find that it's not that good art is not being made in New York. I wouldn't say that. But you find these pockets. You always find these pockets with artists where they live, where they can afford to live. And so that the rent's cheap enough so that they can spend all their time making their art. You know, it's difficult. But I think back on a time like that, especially at 2007, I mean, it was still... we had moved back up, I think, to upstate New York, and it was on the rise, like financially, like it was climbing higher and higher. The prices were getting higher and higher, and it was more difficult to live in the city. A lot of people left, so you would find situations and circumstances even at that time, 2007, because it just kept escalating until COVID, and now it's right back where it was before COVID. That you have these wonderful experiences. I'm not sure if people are able to have the same kinds at this point, just because it's people are working. It's a working city. I mean, wouldn't you say, Kathy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2007 is a really specific year too, because I mean, you're talking about financial crisis, right? Recession is approaching. I mean, we didn't even know what we were going through, but it was happening. And
Lehman Brothers might have known, Kathy, to be fair. They might have had some sort of an indication.
Well, you know, maybe watch that movie, The Big Short, just to recap. But but it's a funny time, because even I remember going to New York in 2007, but I was going every year. Two reasons. One, to either visit my grandmother, or two, to escape a hurricane. So whichever, it could be the reason. But it's... But it's also just when you keep reminding yourself of what was happening. Every year I went back, there was always something either new or something gone.
And it was escalating more and more and more. I'm wrong in my facts, which is a third thing. Forgetfulness. Let's see.
Stop putting yourself down, Pamela. Let's move on to another little topic. Which is something which is becoming ever more prevalent with respect to the creative arts in general, Adrian, and that, of course, is the role of artificial intelligence. I think I can confirm, as far as the listener is actually concerned, that we are all real live human beings, although I've been asked the question many a time and can understand people being confused about me in all sorts of ways after that myself. But in terms of that, Do you feel that that can be an asset? I mean, they're getting more and more sophisticated in terms of the writing, in terms of the programs and so on. Any particular thoughts on that one, Adrian? I mean, certainly within education, how do you feel the future is looking?
Well, I think computers, you know, I think if you're a very creative person and you've got original ideas, I think it could be really, really useful. And I think, you know, with computers now, things are so immediate. I mean, we're sort of having a chat and we're miles away from one another and it's so instant. And that's the thing that I like about it, because I always find that I have to sort of edit things frequently. So the computer is fantastic for me personally. And I've done little bits of computer-generated imagery, but I think with some of the current younger artists, they want to sort of work with past formatting and future and current formatting. So I think, you know, both of the forms of expression are important things. And we have to move on, you know, it's the other thing to remember.
I think the question, of course, is what happens if the computer decides and determines that ultimately it can actually produce a much better individual and have a much better conversation than effectively we can ourselves? And that is one of the dangers that frequently happens. But, you know, maybe that's just me embracing my inner panda, as I frequently say. What the heck?
Yeah, I mean, there is something that concerns all of us, I suppose, about technology, that how it's censored and how it can be abused, and it's open to abuse, which is unfortunate. But I think the thing about it is that it was created, you know, so that people can actually use it in a positive way, you know.
Very optimistic note to actually end on in terms of good intentions, because Pamela has brought us round to those last two questions, which you can deliver either in panda fashion or indeed pink flamingo fashion, or any fashion you wish.
Yes, Adrian, this has been such a lovely chat. I wish that I had had some tea, because this would be a really nice chat to drink. Don't you think? So tea and biscuits, so
yeah. Well, I've got my cold drink here, so cheers.
Have you had a good time with us? And that's the first question. And the second question truly is will you come back? And I'd love if the answer to number two is yes. I think it'd be fun to bring some artists back together, some visual artists, you know, on the same Zoom, don't you? Okay, so question one, question two, and I guess there's a third question.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it very, very much. And yeah, I'd love to come back. But my last visit to New York was 2018. So, you know, maybe there might be there might be another visit, maybe.
You could conceivably actually ask somebody or buy a Pamela Sue Mann album, and then actually end up possibly being able to knock on Pamela Sue Mann and Jerry Leonard's door, and they may, if they're not busy, be able to actually have a word with you. Who knows?
Maybe even a cup of tea.
Yeah.
How can people actually follow you, Adrian, on the social media? Have you actually got your Instagram account set up? Is there a TikTok? What's the best way of actually following Adrian Clamp online?
I've had to write them down, actually, Alex. So on Instagram, it's all small case, and it's adrianclamp.art. And then on Facebook as well. So if you do a Facebook search or a Google search, but on Facebook, it's Adrian Clamp, large case for the A and large case for the C. And then I've got an Adrian Clamp art page as well, and it's large A case and large C case. I've got a music site as well, music community site. So,
and if people, if we had that time machine, which we do because it's called reading, if we actually could actually look through that time bounce, and you could actually speak to the young Adrian Clamp back in 1973, listening to Starman for the first time, what would you say to him?
Gosh, that's a tough one, that is, Alex.
It's a cliffhanger, you see. We know you're going to come back, so it needs to be a cliffhanger to actually work through.
I might have to have a bit of a think about that one. But I'd probably say to myself, good luck, and just go for it.
Pamela, what is New York home of?
She says with pride, New York is home of the world's finest pickle.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, that was all he said. Then the loud sound, it seemed to fade. Came back like a slow voice on a wave of fade. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it, let the children use it, let all the children do get. Starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it.